UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on bethinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to bethinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Now, in general, I would say that the world spirit, from the Christian viewpoint, the world spirit that surrounds the world spirit in general might be called humanism. Humanism, of course, has two different meanings. There's the technical meaning, the narrow meaning of humanism, the philosophy of Julian and Aldous Huxley, and so on. But I'm not thinking of that. I'm thinking of a broader humanism. A humanism in the sense that it begins with man only and works outward from himself. And in this sense, this marks the stream of man's thinking, man's culture, as we look at it in different places. Taking a man, putting him in the center of the universe in the areas of knowledge, standards, and of integration. Wherever we turn, this is all there is to which we must find integration, is in man himself. But if we're going to talk truly to the man of our generation, and if somebody like myself says that we can have a communication with those who are typical 20th century people without a leap of faith, it's imperative that we really think what the world spirit is, what the mentality is, so that we're not missing each other. I would say that this is a matter of linguistics. I don't think it's a matter of anything else. I think what is involved here is the same situation that if we went to China and expected to communicate with someone, we must learn Chinese. If we went into a town where nothing but Chinese was spoken, and we spoke only English, the possibility of communication would immediately come to an end. And I want to say to you, I think this is just as true in the cultural differences of our own generation. I feel we cannot expect to preach the gospel, to try to communicate the answers which Christianity claims to have into our generation without understanding the thought forms which we're facing and without taking these things into account. I feel to try to preach the gospel to other than the upper middle class and to the bourgeois, except for that, to try to preach the gospel without taking time to understand what we're facing will bring as little result in most cases as trying to speak in China to those who speak only Chinese without learning the language. Now as we come and study the cultural history, if you're taking a course in cultural history in general, we find that in many places one can point out a tendency for there to be something of a uniform, a monolithic cultural framework in a certain generation. Now if you're studying in the older periods, of course, in archaeology and so on, one finds that this unified spirit moves slowly. And in as you go back a long way and study in archaeology, you can find, for example, the Aryan people. You find a certain mark of this culture. It's at such a place. And then later, you find that a long, long time afterwards, the same mark appears somewhere else. This is related, of course, to the problem of the spread of knowledge at that particular time. But in our own day, it is quite a different thing. In our own day, the problem of the spread of knowledge is completely different. The spread not only of knowledge, but of impact, attitude, or the continental word, mentality, which is a very different thing. Consequently, the concept of a more close-knit, worldwide mental attitude is a much easier one for our generation than it would have been previously. So therefore, I'm not saying that there has ever been a totally monolithic cultural pattern. This certainly could not be sustained. But rather that there is a tendency with great pockets of exceptions, but there is such that can be thought of the question of the mentality, the cultural framework of a particular period. And that includes, I think, the comprehension of this for our own period. Further than this, I feel that our own type of education does not lead many, many times to a consideration of a unified cultural pattern. our type of educational format with its high specialization leads to the disciplines moving rather in parallel columns rather than being concerned with across associations. You can say, well, this is necessary in our own day simply because things are so specialized, there's so much knowledge, this is fair enough. But nevertheless, one is in a peculiar position if we're only thinking in parallel lines in the disciplines without seeing the total cultural relationship. I think Christians, those standing in the historic stream of Christianity, again, have been particularly slow at this point. Slow in understanding the relationship, slow in understanding the association in the various areas of thought. And this is what I want to wrestle with tonight, the relationships, the associations in the various areas of thought. And you must bear with me, this is not a year's lecture. It's only one night's lecture, and only three altogether. So there's not time to develop everything. What I'm trying to do is giving rather a quick statement as to something of these relationships as I would see it. There seems to me a truism that if we're going to have a communication, you keep using the word communication because that's a very nice word today. Everybody talks about communication. If we're going to have a communication and understand each other, we must understand something of what the other man, how the other man thinks, the form in which he is thinking. Now, if this has ever been so, that one has to take into consideration the differences between the in cultural steps, it seems to me that's especially true with this line. Because I think the comprehension of where we stand today perhaps turns upon realizing what a chasm there is before this line and after it. I would say that the line represents between the last generation and this one at least 400 years. Choosing this figure not just at random, but saying that those who lived prior to this line were much closer to the Renaissance man or the Renaissance man than they are to those who live under this line. That living here before this line, which I've called the line of despair, choosing a name, those who live here before this line are very close to the Renaissance man, but very far away, actually, from the one who lives underneath this line. One's aware of this all the time, the constant talk about the parents not understanding the children, the constant talk about the children not understanding the parents, the talk in many churches, we are not preparing our young people for college, something like this. I think these are all related to the same thing. There is always a discrepancy between generations, fair enough, but I think anyone who fails to understand that this line here is a larger discrepancy, a great deal larger discrepancy than the normal line between generations, misses the whole point of our present problem. I would say is a total break, is a new era, a chasm that exists between, in the thinking, and you remember I put the date in America, this break beginning somewhere around 1930 or slightly before. So what you have here now is, if we were ever going to communicate, surely this is an important factor today, where there's such a division between those who live before this and those who live after it. First of all, in philosophy, and of course, where you begin in philosophy is a matter of choice. You can go back to India, to the Harappa culture, about 2,600 years before Christ. You can begin with the Greeks. You can begin with the Renaissance. In the consideration of philosophy. But I would suggest that wherever you begin, that philosophy can be said before this line to have taken a certain pattern. That before this time, wherever you begin, you find men thought of philosophy in something of saying, here is a circle. Here is a circle. And this circle will contain the knowledge which you ascertain. The knowledge which you find in the external world will be able to be fit into this circle. More than this, it's not only that external knowledge can be fit into the circle, but also that all of life can be fit into this circle. Consequently, to take a very simple thing of the Greeks, all was fire. This was supposed to be a statement which would encompass the whole once the whole was comprehended. Now, however, as you run through the history of philosophy, and the history of philosophy is often a very discouraging subject, And I think the reason for that is that the history of philosophy runs something like this, that a man will set up such a circle and say, and as I say, you can go back to India and see the beginning, I think, of this, or the Greeks, and you can say a man set up and said, this circle will encompass the knowledge and it will encompass life. And then someone says, not at all. Here's a failure in this, but this circle will. And the next man says, no, of course not, but this circle will. And the next man would say, not at all, but this one will. And the next one, no, but this one will. And the next one, this one, and down all the way through the study of philosophy. I think that's why that many people who begin studying philosophy with a history of philosophy, especially if they're studying by themselves or without a good teacher, get discouraged and throw the whole thing out of the window and go off the bridge. It's discouraging to continue this endless seeing failure and then holding your breath for the next answer and have it swept away like the one before. Now then, as we begin with the philosophy with the Greeks, let us say, and then come to the Renaissance and think of the philosophy in Florence especially, and then proceed from that to the Germans, and this was the stream of philosophic thought, we would come in these circles down to here, to this point. And at that particular point, we come to a man who's changed everything, and that is Hegel. To Hegel. And Hegel said something different. And people have often asked me, why do you think this line of despair has come? Why did it appear when it appeared? Why has philosophic thinking changed in structure? And my personal answer would be that I think it is like this, that if you took a man and put him in a circular building in the pitch dark with a large radius, circumference to the building, pitch black, no exits, no doors, no windows, and he feels his way to this round building, and he feels around it, seeking desperately for an exit, that surely he would go around two or three times, covering the same ground, before he came to the conclusion there was no exit. But at a certain point, it would dawn on him that the whole fabric of the thing had gone astray, and there was no exit. It seems to me that by the time you come to Kant and to Hegel, that men had come to the conclusion that they had exhausted the possibilities, starting on the basis of their own humanist presuppositions, beginning with man only with that integration point, that they had discovered that really they had gone over the same ground over and over and over and over again, and they had come out to the place where they were in finding a rational answer. An answer wherein they could say now, with confidence, here is a new circle, and knowledge and life can be placed in that circle. Suddenly, I think they came to the place where these things were exhausted. Before the time of Hegel, you put Kant, and I would put Kant and Hegel as the doorway into the lines of despair. Before the time, of course, of Hegel, people had thought in the areas of cause and effect in a very definite way. There is a cause, it causes an effect, the effect becomes a cause, the cause causes an effect, like numbering up numbers, something like this. But with Hegel, of course, he began, and I think it's after the thing is exhausted, as I've said, he came to a different proposition. And the different proposition is simple and yet profound. And it is the explanation, I think, of the cultural changes of our modern world. And that is, instead of cause becoming effect, and that becoming a cause which was an effect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, instead of that, of course, most of you will know this, Hegel set up a thesis, and against this an antithesis, and this produces a synthesis. Now the reason, however, Hegel is called an idealist by most people, even though he's made this change, is because he still, in his writings, makes plain that he more or less feels that such a synthesis can be definitely and certainly ascertained. When Hegel put this forth somewhere in the Germanic world, surely it would not have seemed like so much of a bang, of a big thing. But of course, with this, with the change as we are now, one can say that Hegel is king, that Hegel has won. The modern man thinks not in terms of antithesis, but of synthesis. The solution, whether it is in the moral world or in the political world, for example, is to be searched for not in the forms of that which is right and that which is wrong, but in finding a synthesis rather between the two. So I would say we are Hegelian in a very real way in the 20th century world. The next man would be Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard has often been said to be the father of existentialism. And whether one is going to put him on one side of the line or another depends upon one's feeling about the matter in a way. But certainly he is included here, at least one must say, in that which is the doorway into the change in philosophic thinking from the old thinking to the new. Kierkegaard made a contribution. And his contribution was that rather than this idea being worked out with some degree of rational certainty in finding the synthesis, that in reality, the synthesis in the profound things of life was to be conditioned upon a jump of faith. A jump of faith. That the solution in the real problems of life was no longer to be thought of in the old framework at all, but rather in the jump of faith.